a brief introduction. Why are we interested in establishing a domestic source of natural rubber? First, Congress and the military have both indicated that natural rubber is a strategic raw material. Right now, all the major rubber users are predicting a worldwide shortage by 2020. Currently, we import, as a country here in the USA, over 1.2 million metric tons per year. This is second only in value of imports to petroleum. We're the second largest user of natural rubber in the world. China has recently passed us as number one, and India is close on our heels to be number two. Current supplies depend entirely on Hevea, or the Brazilian rubber tree, as most people know it, which has a very narrow genetic base. All the plantings in the world are established from three clones, and it is clonally propagated. It's not seed propagated. And then right now there is a major leaf blight epidemic in South America and Africa that has not yet reached Southeast Asia, which is where 72% of our world production comes from, just three countries, Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. And these countries, as they become more industrialized or more Americanized, as our speaker talked about last night, they're switching from rubber plantations to oil palm plantations because it requires less labor and gives them more money. So why are we interested in Waiuli here in the U.S.? First of all, it's a native of the Chihuahuan Desert, which is in central Mexico and the southwest U.S., so it's a crop that's here. It's been commercialized for rubber production at least three or four times over the since the 1900s. The Indians or Native Americans used it as a source of rubber back before Columbus ever got here. So it's been around a long time. It's been through some commercialization efforts in the past. There's a lot of diversity within our Waiuli populations that we have for leaf color, leaf shape, plant size, rubber content, resin content, growth habit, all kinds of variation there. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to tap into some of that variability as well as we would like to. We need higher yielding cultivars if we're going to be successful commercially, but apomixis and ploidy level variation in those populations have really hindered our genetic improvement. Diploids that are found in those populations are generally higher in rubber content, and they reproduce sexually. Polyploids that are in those populations tend to be apomictic or asexual in their reproduction, and larger plants with higher yields. Hand counting, of course, of chromosomes, if any of you have ever tried to do it, is very labor-intensive. So if you're trying to screen thousands of lines in a breeding program for chromosome level, that can be very tedious. And in the case of Waiuli, where you have about less than 1.5 Waiuli breeders in the world, it's impossible. So flow cytometry has been used successfully in several other crops recently to determine ploidy levels and some other factors. And so the objective of our experiment then was to try to adapt flow cytometry for ploidy analysis in Waiuli and then use it to evaluate ploidy levels in three breeding populations that we have. We used the Partec ploidy analyzer as our flow cytometry unit. We found through preliminary tests that the best way to the best source of material, if I can find the, is a fully expanded leaf that is subtending an immature flower stalk, and this is an immature flower stalk. Leaves that are younger than this tend to be still dividing rapidly, and there's too much genetic material there to give you good results. And leaves that are older than that tend to have rubber and resin concentrations already that also interfere with DNA isolation. So we take a leaf from a known diploid plant, a leaf from an unknown ploidy level plant, put in 1 mL of woody buffer, and then finally chop it for about 30 seconds with a razor sharp razor blade. Then we remove the buffer solution with the DNA in it by pipetting it, filter it through a disposable nylon filter, and then add a little DAPI stain to it, and then put it on the ploidy analyzer. And we can get a nice peak. This is a diploid peak, and we adjust this then in, when we're doing unknown samples, to a 100 level so that we know that that's the diploid level. We can determine the ploidy level then by this formula that was published by Dozell and others. You take the mean position of the peak for your unknown, divide it by the peak of your standard. So if this is 100 and this is 100, you get 1, you multiply it by 2, and you get a diploid. If this is 150 and this is, and your standard's 100, then you get 3, which is a triploid. And you can do that all the way up. You can do the math. It's not hard. So we used 3 populations. The first was 34 plant introductions, which from the Whaley germplasm collection at Parlier. Then we had a traditional breeding population that we had developed through some open pollination, and a transgenic population. We verified chromosome counts in the PI population with 6 of them. A diploid is this one, and then a couple of examples of a triploid, then a tetraploid, and then a pentaploid. And Bern Freebe at Kansas State did the chromosome counts and provided us with the pictures. And all those results up to now are in a paper, Gore et al., that will be in Crop Science soon. It's in 2010. It's been accepted. This is an example of some peaks that you get with the 2X 36 chromosome diploid standard. 11591 is one of our USDA lines that we use as a check as a triploid. And then one of our new releases, AZ2, which is a tetraploid. So from that first study, we concluded that we found a natural polyploid series ranging from diploid to pentaploid. Tetraploids were the most common among the PIs. We found 4 PIs, however, that had multiple ploidy levels among different plants that we checked in there, which is not surprising since there are bulk collections from locations that you would, that you might expect to pick up some different variation there. But it does point out the need to verify the chromosome number of individual plants if you're going to make selections or if you're going to use them in some other type of experiment. Then the next thing that we did was we went out and looked at one of our traditional breeding populations that we developed by open pollinations. Again, we used our diploid standard, the same one that we used in the PI test. And we found several other diploids in that breeding population, which was good because in the PIs we'd only found 2 diploids, and they're going to be necessary for making crosses. We also found some triploids and tetraploids as we did in the PIs. So again, we found the natural polyploids series ranging from diploid to pentaploid. Again, tetraploids were the most common, and these agree pretty much with what we found in the plant introductions. And that's not really unexpected since a lot of the selections and stuff that have come out of this population over the years are in the PI collection, and a lot of the PIs were parents in the original population to establish the original population. The next thing we looked at was a transgenic population that we had where 4 different proprietary genes and a couple of ARS genes had been inserted into a tetraploid, and we evaluated over 300 plants in that population, and every one of them came back tetraploid. So we thought, well, that's great. You can do transgenics and not have to worry about ploidy variation affecting your results. But then we looked at a diploid that had just gone through tissue culture and hadn't been transformed yet. We looked at 20 plants, and 18 of them gave us nice diploid peaks on the left over there. But we did find 2 plants. One turned out to be a triploid, and one turned out to be a pentaploid. So if we're going to be doing transgenic work, we're going to have to check our ploidy levels. So from these 2 experiments or 2 populations, we found only tetraploids in those lines that were transgenic from a tetraploid plant, but when we looked at 20 plants from a diploid, we found 2 plants that were not diploid, And if transformations are planned in Wylie, we're going to have to do some chromosome evaluation, both prior to and after transformation, to make sure that ploidy level is not causing the effects rather than the transgene itself. More recently, in some cooperative work that Mike Gore has instituted with Diane Kostich at Cornell, the genome size of Wylie has not been reported previously, and it's always been assumed, well, it's in the sunflower or composite family. It's probably pretty close to sunflower. But what we found was for the diploids, we had a genome size of about 2.2, and she ran some of the diploid material. We sent her triploids, tetraploids, and a pentaploid, and when we did a simple correlation with the genome size numbers she sent us, we got a nice R-squared of 0.999, which I don't think ever in my career of over 37 years I've ever been able to get an R-square of 0.999. So that made us very happy, and we think actually at this level it's closer rather than to sunflower. Sunflower gives results up closer to 3, variations from 2.8 to 3.3 in the literature. It's very close to lettuce. Lettuce comes in about 2.3, so the genome size is going to be closer to lettuce, we think. We've also used the system to look at some of the wild species that are related to Parthenium argentatum. This is Parthenium incanum, which in Texas it grows in the same fields. You'll find it intermixed with it completely. And in the literature, it's been reported as a tetraploid, and we got similar peaks with our results here. Then we looked at another one, Parthenium integrifolium, which is more native to the Midwestern U.S., and you get this peak way out here that's a little more than a hexaploid. And we also had sent her samples, Diane's samples of these, to run for genome size, and the results agree pretty much with what we saw, again, on the ploidy level analysis, in that the diploid is down around 2.2, and canum is about the tetraploid level, and then you got integrifolium that's way out there in the hinterlands. One thing that we have not done yet is do hand chromosome counts for either one of these species to verify whether this is actually increases in chromosome number, or are we seeing in these other species maybe some larger chromosomes than what we have in argentatum. So that work still needs to be done. So then in conclusion, we've successfully used the ploidy analyzer to rapidly and successfully determine ploidy level in Wylie plants and lines. We found a natural polyploid series ranging from diploid to pentaploid, with tetraploid being the most common. The ploidy results are closely related to genome size. And the ploidy analyzer has also been used to estimate ploidy levels in some related species successfully. And we feel like these results will be of use to us in our breeding and genetic studies as we move into mapping and some of the other molecular work that will need to be done in the future. Of course, I want to give acknowledgments. Gwen Coyle is a technician with us, and Gwen was very instrumental in getting the basic procedure established and method established. Stephanie Johnson and Greg Leake are my technicians who have maintained the plant material and who are now doing the routine ploidy analysis of the other populations and the PIs. Bern Freebie at Kansas State, who did the chromosome counts and provided us with the chromosome pictures. Denise Kostich at Cornell, who's doing the genome size work. And Alan Brown, who was formerly the curator at Parlier, who provided the PI material to us originally. And if there are any questions and there's time, I'll be glad to try to answer questions. All the blue-green material that you see in the background there is a wild stand of Wylie in Texas. This picture was taken about 30 years ago. If you go back to those sites now, none of that wild germplasm is available. So it's another one of those native species that we need to be collecting germplasm ASAP, or we're going to be losing it. So thank you very much.
Any questions, Scott Carey, please?
You tried to look at the geographical or morphological correlates to the employee variation. The reason I ask that is there's a paper, not even a year old, in Taxon yet, suggesting that any formally considered intra-employee variance within species really represent early species. And that would be an interesting follow-up to this, to see if those employee variance
for the most part, they occur together. They're not in separate locations. You'll find ploidy variation in wild species all in the same place. There are morphological differences. Even with the wide variation that's in Parthenium that you see, those variations are, once you see the flowering of the plant, you know it's a Parthenium species. They may be different species, but it's definitely in the Parthenium genus. What transgene did we use in the transgenic population? AZ2 was the original line that was transformed. I cannot give you the genes because that's proprietary with one of the companies. The one gene that we did use from ARS that's not proprietary is an HMR gene. It's in the rubber biosynthesis pathway. Tommy? The question is about epimixis and is it related to ploidy level? Yes and no. That's a good answer, isn't it, Tom? Good political answer. Generally speaking, because there are exceptions to the rule, generally speaking, the higher ploidy levels, tetraploids and triploids, are apomictic.